Today, as we continue our series on David, I'm aware that most people are pretty familiar with two stories from David's life. Even people that know nothing about the Bible, maybe don't go to church, there are two stories from David's life that most everybody knows. One is that they know he killed a giant, a guy named Goliath. And the second story most people are aware of is that he slept with another man's wife. It's kind of the highest of the highs and the lowest of the lows. That tends to be the mile markers by which we measure a person's life. And those are the two most well-known stories from David's life. We spent several weeks talking about David and Goliath, and we're going to spend a few weeks talking about this moment, the lowest moment in David's life as well. And to be honest with you, I've been dreading this part of the story, talking about this part of David's life, because talking about this part of his life, well, it forces us to discuss some things that are very uncomfortable to discuss. It brings us into talking about sexual sin, and that's not something that's comfortable to talk about. It's not something we enjoy talking about. But the truth is, we have to talk about it. It's important for us to talk about. The Bible has a lot to say about human sexuality. And because it does, the church needs to have a lot to say about human sexuality as well, because the Bible outlines for us what is normal, what life looks like, and what God calls us to and expects from us. And part of the danger is that historically the church has been very silent on this important issue. And what happens is, if the church is silent on this, then everything we hear and everything we learn is going to come not from an unbiblical perspective, but from an anti-biblical perspective. And we see evidence of that every day, don't we? We see it in the news, we see it in politics, we see it on websites and in video games and music and movies and TV shows and social media, and even in our schools, we see it all around us. So as we begin this part of David's story, let me start by just saying very clearly that sex was God's invention. It is not inherently evil, and God is not opposed to it. In fact, the first command God gave to mankind when he created Adam and Eve, his first command to them was, be fruitful and multiply. And that's kind of flowery language for something specific that we're pretty aware of, right? What's he telling them to do? He's telling them to make babies and lots of them, multiply. Like, that's a lot of kids. And there's a specific act that needs to happen between a man and a woman for that to take place. So God's first command to Adam and Eve, he creates them, pronounces them husband and wife, and then he says, I want you to enjoy each other, and I want you to have lots of kids. In fact, in the Old Testament, there's an entire book called the Song of Solomon that is written about the joys of sex between a husband and wife. And so God is not in any way opposed to sex. He does, however, give instructions. And there's a reason for that. You see, since God invented sex, he knows why he invented it. He knows what it's there for, why it exists, and he understands how powerful it is. And that it's powerful for good or for evil, depending on how we handle that. And so God gives us specific instructions. And if you take the totality of what the Bible says about human sexuality and pare it down to a simple statement about what is acceptable in God's eyes and what is not, it can be very simply said in this way, that sex is a gift given by God for a man and a woman to enjoy in the context of marriage. Like, that's the whole biblical teaching on sex in one simple statement. It's a gift from God for a husband and a wife to enjoy in the context of marriage. And anything outside of that, according to God's word, is a perversion of that gift. Anything outside of that is disobedience to him. And so one of the questions is, because we live in an age where the mantra is, the morality of how our culture views sex is, well, as long as it's two consenting adults, it doesn't really matter. So why does God care? What does he care what we do and when we do it and who we do it with? Why does it matter to him? What matters to him, because he designed it and he knows how it works and how it functions. He knows that sexual intimacy, it connects a man and a woman on a very deep emotional level. There's a lot more to it than just the physical aspect. It connects us on a very deep emotional level. And because of that, it has great power to deepen a couple's relationship, to intensify the bond that they have as husband and wife if it's managed in the correct way. But if it's misused, if it's abused, if it's handled in a way that is unscriptural, the result of that is it causes deep emotional wounds. And it can inflict lasting scars in a way that nothing else can. And we're going to see that very clearly as we dig into this passage in 2 Samuel chapter 11. The book of 2 Samuel can roughly be divided into two halves. The first half deals with David's triumphs. It talks about how David expanded God's kingdom, expanded the kingdom of Israel, and all of his military victories, and how Israel is growing and taking over all these this new land. And David is incredibly successful. That's the first half of this book. But then the second half deals with David's tragedies. It focuses on his fall away from God and the lasting consequences of his sin, and how his sin not only impacted him, it impacted his family, it impacted his military, it impacted those close to him, it impacted the entire nation, and that consumes the last half of this book of 2 Samuel. And it all starts in chapter 11, verse 1. So let's take a look, starting in verse 1. In the spring of the year, when kings normally go out to war, David sent Joab and the Israelite army to fight the Ammonites. They destroyed the Ammonite army and laid siege to the city of Rabbah. However, David stayed behind in Jerusalem. Now, just to set up the story of what is about to happen, David is in Jerusalem, his army is out fighting, and he stayed behind. Now, that's not necessarily a bad thing. I've heard people talk about, well, he stayed behind because he had ulterior motives. There was some nefarious reason that he stayed behind. Well, it doesn't really say that. We don't really know why he stayed behind. Maybe he was sick. Maybe he had been wounded. We don't really know. Maybe it was just a mop-up operation. Things were pretty well taken care of, and he didn't need to be there. We don't really know why he stayed behind. All we know is that he stayed behind, and him staying behind, it was unusual. Like, David's might was in his military victories. He was a warrior king. And part of God's calling for him was to expand Israel's territory, to expand their borders, and he was very effective at doing that. So we don't know why he stayed behind, but we do know that while his men were off fighting, David stayed behind in Jerusalem, and that was very unusual. Let's continue the story. Verse 2. It says, late one afternoon, after his midday rest, David got out of bed and was walking on the roof of the palace. As he looked out over the city, he noticed a woman of unusual beauty taking a bath. He sent someone to find out who she was, and he was told she is Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam and the wife of Uriah the Hittite. And then David sent messengers to get her, and when she came to the palace, he slept with her. Later, when Bathsheba discovered that she was pregnant, she sent a message to David saying, "I'm pregnant." We're only a few verses into the story, and already David has broken two of the Ten Commandments God gave us. He has coveted another man's wife, and he has committed adultery. Within a few verses, this is as far as we're going to go in the story for today, but within a few more verses, he's going to break another two of the Ten Commandments. We'll get to that in the coming weeks. For right now, I want to start by making just a couple of observations. First one is this, and these are both very important for us to catch hold of. The first observation is that David's failure came during his leisure hours. It happened when he had time on his hands. It happened when he had no purpose to pursue. There was no great cause that he was fighting for at that time. And I think it's kind of a tendency of human nature, isn't it? That temptation tends to have its strongest pull when whatever the temptation is the biggest thrill in our lives. When whatever that thing that's tempting us is the most exciting part of our lives, it tends to have a bigger pull on us. When we're not engaged in a purpose that's bigger than we are, when we're not engaged in fulfilling some calling that makes us come alive, temptation tends to be more tempting to us. We've all heard the saying, idle hands are the devil's tools, an idle mind is the devil's workshop. The point of that is not that you should never have any downtime. The point of that is not you should never take a rest. You should work hard all the time, constantly, never taking a break. That's not the point of that. The point of that is that when we are not pursuing something of consequence, when we're not investing our lives in something that matters and has eternal value, when we're not doing that, then the allure of evil tends to be much stronger. And so the issue in resisting temptation isn't just, well, just don't do it. That's not the issue. It's not only don't do this, it's do this instead. Instead of just saying, I'm not going to do this, I'm going to do this thing over here that matters and that has value instead. And as I do this thing that matters, this that's tempting to me doesn't become as tempting. It's not just about saying no to the one thing. It's about saying such a strong yes to something else that's more important, that captivates my attention, that motivates my interests and passions, that other thing is not as appealing to me anymore. You see, if you have a purpose you're living for, if you have a mission that you are investing your life in, then temptation doesn't look as appealing. It looks like an inconvenience. It looks like a distraction from fulfilling the mission that we are living for. So the point of that is, if you're struggling with temptation, one of the ways to handle that is find out, what is God's purpose for me? What is it that I should be living for? What is that calling that is bigger than me, that makes me come alive? And as I invest in that, then the temptation tends to lose its power. Here's the second observation. David's failure did not happen suddenly. It didn't just happen. It wasn't something that was outside of his control. This temptation and this sin, it followed a fairly predictable pattern. There were several steps involved where David could have stopped the process at any point and saved himself and the entire nation from years of grief and tragedy. But what happened was, at every single step, he said yes and took the next step. And then he said yes and took the next step, and so on, until he got himself into a very, very major difficulty. But this temptation and the sin David pursued, it follows a very simple pattern. And if we understand that pattern, it will give us power. It will give us a tool to stand up against temptation when we have to face it. Before we talk about that pattern, let me just point out something about how it works, how the pattern works. It works this way. Temptation usually starts very small. It usually starts with something that appears to us as, well, it's no big deal. It's harmless. It's not hurting anyone. It's not that big of a thing. It usually starts very small. But what begins small tends to become much larger the more we find ourselves following it. Just to give you an opposite example of this, if you remember when we talked about David and Goliath and how David goes up to King Saul and he says, I will fight Goliath. I will fight this giant. And Saul's response was, well, you're just a kid. You're not equipped to do this. There are seasoned military heroes who are terrified of this guy. What makes you think you can stand up against him? And you remember David's response? He pointed back to experiences in his past. He said, as a shepherd, I'm watching the sheep, and a bear came after the sheep, and God empowered me. I grabbed it by the jaw and clubbed it to death. And then a lion came, and I did the same thing. God gave me victory over the bear. He gave me victory over the lion, and so I know he's going to give me victory over this Philistine. And the principle there is that smaller victories prepare us for bigger challenges, and that is absolutely true. But the reverse of that is also true. That smaller sins open the door to bigger sins. Every time we say yes to something small, we are giving ourselves permission to step into something that might be a little bit bigger. When we accept something that is questionable, but it's not over the line, I know I probably shouldn't do this, I probably shouldn't be thinking about this, I shouldn't be watching that or listening to this or doing this with this person, but it's not really over the line, so it's okay. What that does is it gives us permission to go to the next step and then the next step, and it opens us up to more and more temptations. It's kind of, if you ever look at somebody who did some horrific, terrible thing and you think, how could they possibly have done that? Well, it didn't start with that one thing. It didn't start with that horrible thing that ended up on the news. It started out with something much smaller. But as they engaged in that much smaller thing, it opened the door to the next thing that was just a little bit bigger. And as they said yes to that, that opened up the next step to something that was a little bit bigger, and so on, until finally they do something that is so horrific, it just seems unthinkable to us. But the point is, it starts with something small. And part of that starting with something small is we make excuses and we rationalize when we're faced with a temptation. And so maybe, for example, it's a thing of looking at certain pictures or going to certain websites, and the rationalization is, well, you know what? I've worked hard. I deserve this. I'm not hurting anybody. Nobody's gonna know. It's just a little thing. It's not that big of a thing. Maybe that's the rationalization. Or sometimes the rationalization can be, well, it's okay to look, as long as they don't touch. Or maybe the rationalization is taking it further, saying, well, I mean, come on, what am I supposed to do? My wife isn't meeting my needs. What do you expect? Or my husband isn't really tuned into me emotionally, but this person, they really get me. They understand me. It's like we're soulmates. What am I supposed to do? Or maybe the rationalization is, well, it's just an innocent text. It's just an innocent conversation. And yeah, it's a little bit flirty, but we're not gonna cross the line. I know where to stop things. It's not gonna get out of hand. I've got this. But the problem is those smaller things lead to bigger things. Those smaller things that we give into, those little compromises we make, they give us permission to take the next compromise, because then that doesn't seem as big a deal to us either. Or maybe it's begin to watch that TV show, or visit that website, or drive by that store, or look for those magazines, or watch that video. The point is that the smaller steps open the door to larger steps. And when we give ourselves into those smaller steps, we are inviting temptation, we are inviting addiction, we are inviting heartbreak. And the question we need to ask ourselves is not, like a lot of times it's, whether it's a physical relationship outside of marriage, or if it's looking at something we shouldn't be looking at, a lot of times the rationalization is kind of a thing of, well, how close can I get to the line without crossing it? Like, how far can I go and still be okay with God without really breaking his law, without disobeying him? That's not the question we should be asking. Because the Bible tells us to flee from sexual sin, not to walk up to the line and see how close we can get. The Bible says to run from sexual sin because it is incredibly harmful to us. And so the question we should ask is not, how close can I get to the line? How far can I go and still be okay with God? That's not the question. The question we need to ask is, how fast can I run away from that line? How far can I possibly go from anywhere even close to crossing that line? Because the closer I get, the more dangerous it becomes. And that's the question we need to ask ourselves, because it always starts with a small step. Now let's take a look at this pattern, the progression of how sin happened. And to do that, we're going to go back to the beginning. I don't mean the beginning of the story or the beginning of David's life. I mean the very beginning in Genesis chapter 3. So God creates Adam and Eve, and he puts them in this garden, gives them everything they could ever want or need. And he says, every tree here, it's yours. All of the food here, it's available for you. But there's one simple rule, that tree over there, don't eat from that tree. And we know the story. The serpent shows up one day and tempts Eve. And here's what happened. Verse 6. She saw that the tree was beautiful and its fruit looked delicious. She wanted the wisdom it would give her. So she took some of the fruit and ate it. And then she gave some to her husband who was with her, and he ate it too. At that moment, their eyes were open and they suddenly felt shame at their nakedness. And so they sewed fig leaves together to cover themselves. There's a very clear pattern that shows up in this verse, and here it is. I saw, I desired, I took, I hid. In fact, let's say that together. I saw, I desired, I took, and I hid. That is the pattern you and I follow every time we give into temptation. And you see it in this story here with Adam and Eve. So she sees the tree. She sees that it's beautiful. It looks delicious. She desires it. She's like, if I have this, it's going to enhance my life. It's going to make my life so much better. It's going to fulfill me. She wanted the fruit. And then she took it. She took a bite of it. She handed it to her husband. He took a bite of it as well. And then what's the next step? They try to hide. They cover themselves up. God is walking through the garden. They're hiding behind a tree. They're trying to hide themselves from God because they feel ashamed at what they have done. We follow that same pattern every time we give into temptation. We see something. We hear something. A thought pops into our head. That in and of itself is not a bad thing. We can't always control that, right? We can't always control that. But we realize, okay, I shouldn't be looking at this. I shouldn't be listening to this. I shouldn't be thinking about this. I shouldn't be doing this. And so we have a choice, either to walk away or to engage with that thought, to engage with what we see. And as we do, what happens is it takes us to the next thing, and we start toying with the idea. We start rationalizing, well, how far could I go? How could I do this and nobody find out? How could I do this and get away with it? How could I arrange this to work out for me? And the more we rationalize it, the more desire grows. And then we engage. We do the thing that we are commanded not to do. We disobey, and whatever that is. And after that, we feel shame and we feel guilt, and we try to hide it. We try to hide it from other people. We try to hide it from God, pretend, oh, everything's fine. It's not that big of a deal. We try to rationalize ourselves so that we think it's not a big thing. This is the pattern we follow. It's the pattern in David's life too. Take a look again. In 2 Samuel 11, it says, as he looked over the city, he noticed a woman of unusual beauty taking a bath. He sent someone to find out who she was, and he was told she is Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam and the wife of Uriah the Hittite. He sent messengers to get her, and when she came to the palace, he slept with her. Do you see that same pattern here? It's the exact same pattern. I saw, I desired, I took, I hid. He noticed her. He wants her. He's asking questions about her. He slept with her. He violated God's command. He took what did not belong to him. And the rest of the chapter details how he tries to hide his sin. We'll get to that later on. For today, we're just going to talk about this first part in this process. I saw. So David is up on the roof of the palace walking around, and he notices her. Now, has he sinned at this point? He hasn't sinned at this point. He's just walking around, and he happens to see a woman who is attractive to him. That in and of itself is not a sin. What are his options? You can talk. It's okay.
Turn around, walk away.
Best solution right then and there. Turn around, walk away, go back into the palace, and say, okay, God, that was tempting. I don't want to give in to lust. So God, what is your plan for me today? What is my calling? What is it that God has called me to do that makes me come alive, that I love doing to serve him, that really, you know, ignites my gifts and my desires and my passions for life? What is that? That's what I'm going to invest my time in. So I'm not thinking about that anymore. That's his option, right? And it's a fairly simple one. Now, so he's walking around. He sees her. Up to now, everything is innocent. There's nothing wrong with him walking around. There's nothing wrong with him noticing her. There's nothing wrong with that. When it becomes a problem is that second look. It's the lingering. It's the fantasizing. It's the beginning to imagine what it would be like. It's the pursuing it. It's the next step that becomes the issue. And I think that's important for us to understand, because that first step is not sin. Just seeing something, hearing something, a thought popping into our heads, that is not the sinful act. That's the first step in the process, but we have options at that point. And it's important for us to understand that, because we can't always control what we happen to see, or what we happen to hear, or what thought happens to pop into our minds. But we do control what we continue to look at, what we continue to listen to, the thoughts we continue to engage in. We have control over that, and that's the issue. And the main thing we need to get as we think about this pattern, I saw, I desired, I took, I hid. The main thing for us to get today is this. This first step, I saw, this is the place to stop it. This is the place to end it, right there at the very beginning. I see something and I realize if I continue looking, that is sin. I hear something and I realize if I continue listening to this, it is sin. A thought pops into my head and I realize if I continue mulling that thought over, or an idea of doing something, I know if I do that, it's sin. This is the place to stop it, to turn and go the other direction. If David had done that at the very first part, he's up there on the roof, he sees her while she's attractive. If he had decided right then and there, I'm not going to engage in this, I'm going back into the palace, it's over then and there. And he would have saved himself a lot of heartbreak. He would have saved his friend Uriah, whose wife he was looking at, a lot of heartbreak. He would have saved the entire nation from years of tragedy and corruption. He would have saved his own family. Later on, his own sons would turn against him and try to overthrow the kingdom, and it all started back here. He could have ended that at the very first part of the process. I saw and I turned away and I didn't give it any further thought. Boom, story's over. And the other thing about that is it's important for us to know the further we go in that process, I saw, I desired, I took, I hid. The further we go in that process, the harder it is to stop the process. It becomes exponentially more difficult with every step we take. In other words, just to simplify it, it's a whole lot easier for David to say no when he's up there and he notices her. It's a lot easier for him to say no and walk away at that point than it is to say no after he invites her over and she comes into his room to then say, no, this was wrong. Go back home. Let's just forget this whole thing. It's a lot more difficult to say no then than it is when he's on the roof and just notices her. The further we go in that progression, if we're saying to ourselves, I'm going to get real close to the line because it looks like a lot of fun, but I'm not going to cross that line. The closer you get to the line, the harder it is to not cross the line. We've got to understand that. So the earlier in the process we stop it, the easier it is to stand up against temptation. But David continued. And at each opportunity to say no, he said yes. And he took the next step. And he got himself into a lot of trouble as a result. This is why he wrote this in the Psalms. Take a look at this, Psalm 101, verse 3. He says, I will refuse to look at anything vile and vulgar. In Psalm 119, 37, he says, turn my eyes from worthless things and give me life through your word. It's good practice, isn't it? Those were both written by David, the same guy we're talking about right now. That's a good practice. I see something and I realize it's wrong, so I refuse to look at it any longer. A thought pops into my head. Something pops in through my ears. I see something I shouldn't see, an idea to do something that I shouldn't do. And instead of giving myself into it, I turn away from it. I turn my eyes from it and I turn my mind from it. And sadly, David did not follow his own advice in this instance. So just to make this real practical, let's just be honest. We all know our weak spots, don't we? We all know those areas of temptation where we tend to give in the most frequently. And one of the best practices is for us to avoid those opportunities as much as possible. The people, the places, the situations where temptation tends to have its strongest pull. One of the simplest ways is for us to avoid that as much as we possibly can. Like if David had known that she was out there, he could have made a decision. Okay, turn my eyes away. I'm choosing not to look. If he had known she was there and chosen to follow his own advice, he could have said, you know what? Today's not a good day to go out on the roof. I'm just going to stay in here and play ping pong or whatever, right? And again, he could have avoided the whole thing just by saying no before the temptation even began. But knowing our weaknesses can be a really helpful tool. So just a few examples. For example, if for you, if alcoholism is a weakness for you, if that's a struggle, and just to be clear, the Bible says it's okay to drink, but it's not okay to get drunk. There's a big difference between the two. And that's like Old and New Testament is very clear on that. So if you're a person, you can have one or two drinks and it's no big deal, that's fine. But if for you, you can't stop at one or two and it becomes a thing, then the best thing for you to do is to avoid certain people, to avoid certain places, to avoid certain restaurants, certain stores, and to just stay away because, let's be honest, you know if you're gonna go there, if you're gonna hang out with them, if you're gonna have that experience, you know you're inviting temptation and addiction and all kind of problems. So the best thing is just to say, I know what's gonna happen if I go there, if I hang out with them, so I'm just not gonna go there to begin with. Because if I do, I'm putting myself in a situation where I know I'm already close to the line and it's gonna be really hard to say no. Maybe for you, the temptation is there's that person at work or that person in your neighborhood and you just feel attracted to them and you know it's not right. But there's this draw there. There's this emotional connection. And you know what? For you, the best thing is just to avoid that person altogether. And if you can't completely avoid them because of a work situation or whatever, then the best thing to do is just covenant with yourself. I will never be alone with that person. And we're not going to swap texts back and forth. We're not going to call each other. We're not going to Facebook friend each other because I know that could lead to some bad stuff. We're not going to get into these flirty conversations and giving each other compliments. And, oh, you look so nice today. And, well, my husband never says those things to me. And don't go there. Because as you do, you're opening the door up. Again, it always starts small, but it usually doesn't end small. And you're opening the door up to something that could lead to some very bad problems in your life. If for you the temptation is those websites or those videos or those pictures online, there's some great tools you can use. A tool like an app like Covenant Eyes, which links you to a trusted friend and mentor who can be an accountability partner for you. There are things you can do on the handout that I gave you this morning. Take a look on the inside there, because there's some really practical things you can use. If this is a struggle for you, I want us to be practical and I want to offer tools that are helpful. Go over this, read through it, take these steps, and it can be very helpful in handling those kinds of temptations and those kind of struggles. The point of all this is this. You and I, we know our weaknesses, and we know the people and the places and the situations that take advantage of those weaknesses. And if we avoid them as much as we can, it's a step forward in obeying God and resisting those temptations. It's important for us to do what David said, not what he did, to do what he said. He said, I will refuse to look at anything vile and vulgar. So when that thought pops into my mind, when I see that thing that is tempting, I'm not going to entertain it. I'm going to turn away from it. He said, turn my eyes from worthless things. So when I see that tempting situation, when I see that tempting person, I'm not going to give it space in my mind. I'm not going to mull it over. I'm not going to make excuses for it. I'm going to turn away from it. I'm going to get out of this situation altogether. In fact, look at what Paul says in 1 Corinthians 6:18. He says, run from sexual sin. He doesn't say, think it over, pray about it, consider it, get close to the line, see how close you can get without getting burned. He doesn't say that. He says, run as far as you can and as fast as you can. Why? Again, God created sexuality and he knows how it works and he knows the power it has for good or for evil. And Paul says, no other sin so clearly affects the body as this one does. Sexual immorality is a sin against your own body. So those verses give us a simple plan of action. Turn your eyes away. Turn yourself away. Walk away from the situation. Run away. Find something worth investing your life in and give that your focus instead. Because the pattern is predictable. I saw, I desired, I took, and I hid. And along the way, I caused a lot of damage to myself. And I caused a lot of damage to the other person. And I caused a lot of damage to those closest to me. So this is the place to stop the process, this very first part. I see something, I hear something, a thought pops into my head, and I realize if I do that, if I continue looking, if I keep listening, I know that that is sin. This is the place to stop it at the very beginning, to run away from that sin, to run away from that temptation, and refocus on something greater and more important. Your life is worth more than giving yourself over to that. So God, I pray that you will help us to stand strong and to be faithful to you. We are surrounded, we are bombarded daily with temptations, whether it's temptation to sexual sin or any number of things. We know that there are areas that we struggle, there are areas where we are weak. And so God, I pray that you will help us to be aware and help us to be invested in living life that honors you. Help us to be invested in living a life of freedom and not being enslaved by sinful habits and sinful behaviors. I thank you that your word gives us guidelines and your word gives us ways to overcome temptation. You have promised us that no temptation is too strong for us to handle, but you always provide a way of escape. Help us to see that way of escape when we are tempted and to take the way out, so we can protect ourselves and those closest to us, and so we can live a life that honors you. I pray especially this morning for anyone that this message maybe hit close to home, and maybe this is an issue that they're struggling with right now. I pray for freedom. I pray for victory. I pray that the habits, the addictions, the temptations, God, I pray that all of that would be overcome in the mighty name of Jesus. Amen. Now, because of the nature of today's message, we're not going to do a hey, anybody have anything they want to share and we can pray for you? We're not going to do that today, just to take away the fear. I just want you to know, if this is something you're struggling with, you need to pray it through, and you need to find someone that you can trust, who can be an accountability person. This is a battle you cannot win on your own. This is a battle that you need to link arms with a person of the same gender, someone who you can trust, someone who has maturity, who you can be honest with, and they're not gonna reject you because of your honesty. They're gonna love you, they're gonna be there for you, they're gonna support you, they're gonna ask you the tough questions, and they're gonna pray with you. You need to find somebody who is willing to be that person for you. And again, on the inside flap of the handout that you got this morning, there's some steps there. Covenant Eyes is a good step. Every Man's Battle, great book, very practical. Get involved in a Celebrate Recovery group. There's tons of them in this area. Those are all tools that are available for us. If this is a struggle, there is freedom from that struggle. But it's gonna take work, and it's gonna take effort, but it's worth it. Because none of us wants to end up in the situation that David found himself. So we're gonna close with a closing song. If you need to talk with one of us, I'm here for you. The elders are here for you. The elders' wives are here for you. If you need somebody to pray with you, don't leave until that happens this morning. So let's all stand together and let's sing our closing song.